Empower Radio presents The Farkas Files, an exploration of energy, metaphysics, and the paranormal with David Franklin Farkas. The Farkas Files. The truth is in here, somewhere. Here's your host, David Franklin Farkas.
Good evening. Thanks for being with us. We're going to have a lot of fun this evening. My guest today is Hillary Webb, who I don't think she's heard me call her this yet, but I consider her to be what I call a spiritual geek. She's from the academic world. She is has studied all kinds of things from an academic perspective, but as she got interested in shamanism, she applied all of those skills to learning about the shamanic ways, both in Peru and interviewing lots and lots of people from all over the world. So she has some fascinating information to share. And we'll do that shortly after tonight's metaphysical musing. And there are four principles that I work with. Everything is energy. Everything is connected. Everything is conscious. And everything is interactive. And the shamanic world is about shifting from what quantum physicists would call the particle form, the physical world, to the wave form, a world of energy. And if you do experiments in physics, you can either set it up so you find waves of energy, or you can set it up so that you find particles, but you can't do both. And if you do find particles, you find them, but you can't tell exactly where they are. It's really interesting stuff, and very much like the world of a shaman. You shift the positioning of your consciousness into the world of energy, non-ordinary reality, non-physical reality, and you see the same world, but in a totally different context. So people think of shamans and psychics and other people that can do that as having, you have to imagine me doing air quotes, powers. You know, you can do things. Well, the truth is, anybody can do that stuff once you learn how to do it. It's not that the particular individual is the one that suddenly comes up with this. It's a natural aspect of being human that we've sort of forgotten in modern culture. So in my work, a lot of what I do is clearing buildings, but I also work with people and other things. And I sit by myself at a desk and I focus on what their issue is in using the various tools that I use. And I send them an email and say that I'm done. And then they usually send me an email and say, oh, wow, this changed and that changed and the other thing changed. And it's like, oh, so how does my mind sitting here in the physical world have a way of understanding that that's even possible? I don't know. I know it's possible because I get confirmation. It's that issue of belief versus experience. Belief is basically hearsay. Someone who strongly believes or had the experience tells you that it's possible or that's the way the world works. And if you trust them, you believe what they tell you, especially if they tell you that over and over again or lots of people around you believe the same thing. Experience always trumps belief. Once you have the experience, you really have to work hard to convince yourself that you didn't have the experience. And now you have to comport that against whatever beliefs you've been told, whatever information other people have told you. So one of the things that happens when you do this stuff is you play around with just everyday things to see how you can affect them. So can I make the traffic light change? So you pull up to the traffic light and do whatever it is you do. You know, my dad used to blow at them. I snap my fingers. And a really high percentage of the time, the traffic light changes. Here's the problem in thinking that you did it. It could be that you just sensed when the traffic light was going to change and through a coincidence, there are no coincidences, it's a coordination of various factors, but what seems like a coincidence, you asked it to change when it was going to change. And then it appears to be something that you did. Well, Another aspect of that is what's called premonitions. And there are a lot of people who have premonitions. And a premonition is basically, in some way, seeing the future, whether you see it in a dream or you see it in your conversation with yourself in your head. And I've been having those experiences a lot in the last couple of days, and it's very different from what my experience has been. And after you've been doing this stuff for a long time, you kind of watch it and go, oh, this is interesting. I wonder where this is going. So I was going through a stack of paperwork and looking at a list of former clients. And for a couple of them, I went, oh, I wonder what's going on with them. Maybe I should send her an email. The next morning when I checked my email, two of the people I said that about had sent me an email saying, I really need your help with whatever it was. So, oh, that's interesting. Now, was that a premonition that I knew that they were going to send me an email in some way? Or was that my desire to send them an email, giving them a signal and getting them to send me an email? I'm not sure. I don't know how to figure that out. I was getting out of my car in the parking lot, and we had a huge ice storm last October that knocked out the power for the whole area and took a very, very long time to clean up because the heavy, icy snow came down on trees that still had the leaves on them, and all that weight just took down lots and lots of tree limbs. So it was a lot of tree trimming that was done. And next to my apartment building was lots of leftover tree limbs and assorted other things that had been cut down and left there all winter. And there was also one tree limb of all the stuff that was trimmed that still hung over my car. And now that the leaves were coming in, it was hanging down right over the hood of my car. I was like, maybe I should call the property manager and ask when this is going to be all cleaned up. So this morning, there was an incredible amount of noise outside. And I thought it was just the usual landscapers with their trimming things. But I went outside, and it was guys with chainsaws who had come to pick up the stuff that I had in my head complained about the day before. And while I was chatting with them, I said, hey, could you guys, my car's over there, could you go and cut that limb so it's not hanging over my car? And they went and did that for me. And what I had asked for in my head, what I said, oh, this should be finished up, should I take some action, happened the next day. Again, was it because I said it and I wanted it and somehow it happened quickly right after I said it or thought it? Or was I noticing that that was happening and realizing it was going to be fixed? I don't know. It's going to take me a while to sort it out. But that's the worldview and the vision of doing this kind of work, doing having a metaphysical perspective, having a shamanic perspective. It's not assuming that it's coincidence. Matter of fact, assuming the coincidence isn't real, that it's serendipity. It's things that are in some way coordinated, in some way we don't understand. So was it something that I was seeing, a premonition, and I just didn't realize that that was what was going on because I don't usually have that happen to me, at least in the past I haven't? Or was it my desire to have it that brought it into the physical world quickly the next day? Coincidence? Well, that's what we're told in the modern world, that it's all coincidence. But when you start looking at it from another perspective, no, I don't think so. I don't fully understand it. It may take me quite a while to figure out how much of it responds to me and how much of it seems to be premonition, but I still don't really know what the difference is. I do know that it's all energy and it's all connected. So that's today's metaphysical musing, and I hope it gives you some new things to think about. And now let's talk to our wonderful guest, Hillary Webb. How are you tonight, Hillary?
Hey, hi. Spiritual geek, I like it. I've been called many things, but I think that's officially my favorite.
All right. Well, I'm glad.
Well, it's great to be here.
I'm glad you're with us. And I don't usually get to meet my guests, but Hillary was in the area doing a talk, and we did get to have coffee one day. So it feels like we're old friends.
Exactly.
And that spiritual geek thing is something that I think about a number of the people that I have the most enjoyable conversations with, because it's that combination of left brain, right brain, the spiritual, metaphysical side of the world, and the much more focused and linear side of things, and bringing them together. Not having just one piece of it going on.
Yeah.
Makes for a very rich way of understanding things.
And it makes it much more fun, I think.
I think so. And you have a fascinating story. If I can just introduce the stuff I know about your work. Mm-hmm. You've had an opportunity. You've written several books about shamanism, so it's obviously your interest, and you've met some fascinating people. And you've also gone to do some in-depth study in Peru with the shamans there. And I'm always fascinated with how people wind up where they wind up, what the path is, what drew you there, how you got there. So why don't you give us, I'm sure it's a long story, but
I can put it in a little bit of a nutshell anyway. Well, first of all, I'm a Scorpio, which I think says a lot right there. So I'm probably naturally drawn to some of the mysteries and the questions. I loved the questions that you were asking, because I think the work in spirituality and consciousness is really draws those of us who love the questions even more than the answers in some ways. At least that's what I find for myself. But and I grew up in Salem, Massachusetts, so I kind of grew up surrounded by alternative religion and alternative perception and alternative ways of looking at the world. And so this is something that's been an interest of mine, this idea of what is consciousness and what is consciousness capable of. You know, it's really been something that's been with me for most of my life, and I've explored in different ways. And, you know, I think as a young child and, you know, on into early adulthood, I was really looking for ways of getting to play with consciousness and how do we find out what its potential is. And what I really found is that is in shamanism. When somebody introduced me to shamanism about 15 years ago, what really struck me was that here we have a set of tools and techniques for going into altered states in which you can have this experience of altered states of consciousness and really get a sense of, you know, certainly not the totality of what consciousness is or even where it begins and ends, but some really paradigm-shattering experiences. And really, I was kind of hooked on shamanism after that, because I was just having these experiences that were, you know, just kind of remarkable things about like non-locality and remote viewing and just being able to gather information that one would not normally be able to gather in an ordinary state of consciousness. So that really hooked me.
My world.
Yes, exactly. Well, I really resonated with a lot of things you were saying at the beginning of the show. You know, that whole idea of quantum physics really does fit into the sort of shamanic paradigm of non-locality and, you know, we are connected, we are one, even when we're not in the same place, and being able to receive information in that way. So, you know, about having been in shamanism for a few years, I suddenly came to this place where I thought, okay, you know, what is the point, really? It was one of those sort of crisis of faiths, I think, and I thought, you know, why have I been doing this? What have I been, what's the traveling and the workshops and everything led up to, and what does it mean for me? And out of that came my second book. It was the first book that I started working on, but the second one published, called Traveling Between the Worlds, Conversations with Contemporary Shamans. And that book is a compilation of conversations with 24 different shamans, shamanic practitioners from different traditions around the world. And really, for me, it was this opportunity to go talk to people whose ideas I respected and say, hey, what is it about shamanism, and how do we use these teachings to help ourselves and each other and the planet, and where do we go with this? So that was a real gift for me, is being able to have this opportunity and this excuse to speak to these really wise people. And after that, I did write a book called Exploring Shamanism that just sort of basically looks at shamanism sort of as a whole. And, you know, after spending a number of years sort of in that experiential aspect of shamanism, where I was sort of doing the shamanic journeying and having different altered state experiences and sort of doing the practices, I decided I wanted to go back to school and really, you know, have that, you know, metaphorical left brain critical thinking, the, you know, the way of thinking about these things in a different kind of way, because I am somebody who loves to sort of switch perceptual states from the experiential to the sort of the more scholarly. So I went back to school and got my master's in consciousness studies from Goddard College, and then I went and got a PhD in psychology with a focus in psychological anthropology and the anthropology of consciousness from Saybrook University. And out of my research for my doctoral work came my latest book, Yanantin and Masintin in the Andean World, Complementary Dualism in Modern Peru. And that's kind of where we come to now.
Right. And I haven't gotten all the way through the book, but I got part way into it. And it's just fascinating. And I think gives a sense not only of one culture's point of view, but of how shamanism works and how having a different perspective about the world and how it works changes everything. Mm. This idea of complementary dualism is really fascinating. So is that a good starting point for talking about what you learned there?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I agree. I mean, I think the thing that draws me to this work more than anything is that, you know, it's sort of become a cliche at this point, but that Einstein quote of you can't solve a problem with the same consciousness that created it. And the thing I love about anthropology, and in particular the anthropology of consciousness, is going to different cultures and saying, how do you relate to the world around you? How do you engage with the world? And sometimes, you know, things that I saw as a problem, they would say, that's not a problem at all. Look at it this way. And suddenly, wow, it's not a problem. And that's a beautiful thing, because no matter what culture you come from, we get kind of locked into our cultural habits of mind. And there we stay until somebody taps us on the shoulder and says, hey, you know, if you turn your head just a little to the right, you can see it this way. So, yeah. So Yanantin and Masintin in the Andean World came out of my research, doctoral research, as I said, into the Andean concept of Yanantin and Masintin. Basically, in a nutshell, that's sort of the indigenous Andean version of the Taoist concept of yin-yang. So it's complementary opposites. And I first heard this word when I went to Peru in 2000 and just to study the shamanic practices down there. And I was sitting with an old shaman. We were doing a despacho, which is a ceremonial offering to the earth, and you take a piece of paper and you make a kind of mandala with different things like candy and flowers and all kinds of different ingredients. And so one of the first things that he put down was this little figurine of a person. It was split down the middle, and half of it was red, the other half was yellow. And he said, this is Yanantin, complementary opposites. And there was something about this idea of complementary opposites that just really, really grabbed me and didn't let go for years after that. And what I came to realize was that, you know, coming from the Western world, we have this tendency to see the opposites of existence, such as male-female, dark light, inner outer, self, other, as being in an antagonism, as being in a war for dominance. That, you know, for the Harry Potter fans out there, it's the idea of, you know, one cannot live while the other survives. You have to dominate one in order for the more real or more virtuous element to exist.
Right.
But in the Andean world, there's really this idea and this dedication to the idea and the philosophy that the opposites are complementary, and that the tensions we experience are just part of the dance of life. And they, you know, the Masintin, that the Yanantin part would be the male-female, the polarity, the pair. The Masintin is the steps of the dance that the pair goes through in order to become complementary. And in my book, I go through the four stages and talk a little bit about that. And so, you know, I went as a doctoral student. I went with my left brain fully strapped on and met with some shamans down there, because they're the ones who are working with these ideas. And I, you know, pulled out my notebook and a pen and, you know, dutifully said, all right, lay it on me. What's the definition? How do you define Yanantin? And Amado, my primary participant, kind of smiled at me. He said, well, you know, out of respect, I don't define Yanantin. You know, it can be defined in many ways. And can I suggest that you download the information from the cosmos instead? At which point, me being an eager doctoral student, wanted to weep because I thought, you know, how am I supposed to do that? You know, and this is despite having a number of years of shamanic practice behind me and, you know, going and belief in these states, which goes to show just how solidified our habits of mind get. So essentially from there, they, you know, you were talking at the beginning of the show about the value of experience. They really wanted me to experience these things rather than just writing down a definition. And the way that they encouraged me to have this experience was by going into ceremony with the San Pedro cactus. And the San Pedro cactus is a mescaline cactus used for thousands of years in the ceremonies there. So the book Yanantin and Masintin in the Andean World is really kind of a left brain, right brain Yanantin. It kind of has a lot of my own story about going into ceremony with San Pedro and also brings in a lot of the sort of more scholarly elements.
Which is an absolutely fascinating read besides everything else. Hearing your story, you know, your well-crafted story about what you experienced, but also there's that academic analytical part of it that sits in the background.
Yeah, I liked having the balance of the two, and I feel very fortunate that I've gone to schools, you know, there are not a lot of schools like this, but schools that would really let me explore it in the way that, well, not only that I wanted to, but that really supported the material. Because right. What I kind of learned very early on was that, you know, if I truly wanted to understand this idea of complementary opposites, I really just could not do it from primarily a left brain endeavor. You know, that was not going to do justice to the material itself. So fortunately, I was in with professors who allowed me to really have an experiential element in the study, which was a great thing.
We're going to be going to break in a couple of minutes, and this is a good transition here. And I want to make sure people have a way to contact you and find your material. So why don't you give your website?
Yes, my website is www.hillarysweb.com. That's www.hillarysweb.com.
Terrific. And we'll make sure that you can give that another couple of times.
Yep.
I also want to give out the call-in number. If we've got people lurking that would like to join the conversation, the number is 248-809-3474. 248-809-3474. I'm really fascinated with the whole process that you went through and the experience that you went through. So when we come back from the break, let's talk both a little bit more about the principles that you were being taught, but also what it was like going through all of that. Because I have my version of it, obviously, you know, my apprenticeship and being thrown into places that I never expected to be. You know, one of the things we talked about briefly today was I had called you a shaman and you said I shouldn't. And there is this thing out in the world that says anyone that calls himself a shaman isn't, because they're calling themselves that.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, we're both shamanic practitioners. We both have done the work. We're both using this in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to acknowledge you as someone who, you know, you've done your walkabout. You've done your homework. You've gone out there and done it. You have that experience. And wanted to acknowledge that you're the real deal.
Oh, well, thank you. That means a lot coming from you.
Whether or not you want to have
to. I still refuse to be called that, though.
even though you don't want to wear the word, which I totally understand.
But thank you. No, that's very kind.
Well, you've done a lot of work. You've done a lot of work. You've been a lot of places. And the been a lot of places is as important in, from my perspective as any of the conceptualizing. You know, it's all about the experience and, you know, whether you'll ever have words for what you learned in the experience, who knows?
Right.
So there's always a whole lot more there than you're ever able to put down on paper. Well, we are going to go to break, and there will be a whole lot more with Hillary Webb when we come back on the Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This heavyweight bout is about to begin. The challenger wears white trunks with a blue stripe, and the champ is wearing, looks like an examination gown from the doctor's office. And from the back, we can... Ooh, that's not pretty. Champ, what's with the crazy getup?
I've got to take care of my family.
Yeah, so?
Well, when you love your family, you got to go in and get those important medical screenings. A lot of potentially deadly diseases can be treated if you catch them in time.
So you wear the examination gown because...
Because I'm a real man. Real men take care of their families and get those tests. Real men wear gowns.
Okay, champ. Good luck. Here we go. The champ's not wasting any time. It's over. This fight is over. Champ, you barely broke a sweat. Any words for your fans out there?
Remember, go to ahrq.gov for a list of the tests they need to get and when to get them.
What was that web address again?
ahrq.gov. And remember, real men wear gowns.
Go to ahrq.gov. This message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services,
ahrq. How do you wake up the entire African-American community to the hidden issue of mental health problems?
It showed up in my life through one of my best friends. And we've been friends for over 30 years.
Share your story.
If we would have known earlier, you know, we would have been much more supportive with her.
Once I reached out to my sister, it got a little better. Once I told my mother, it got a little better. The more I talked about it, I felt it coming off.
The healing is in me, and the healing in a journey can also be extended to others.
It's our community and our mental health.
Giving voice to what you're feeling is part of the healing.
If you're strong enough to just open your mouth, that's all it takes.
And the most revolutionary and healing thing that Black people can do right now is to love one another.
It's time to share ourselves. Healing starts with us. Search online for stories that heal. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Sassy! Sassy!
This week's episode, Bobcat in the Cave.
Gosh, Johnny, playing in the cave sure is neat.
Oh boy, a kitty cat.
Sassy, the kitty cat's yelling. What, Sassy? It's not a kitty? It's a bobcat? Speaking of cats, you like to stress the importance of adopting cats from animal shelters? Over 5 million cats go into animal shelters every year? And with millions of healthy cats to choose from, it's a shame more people don't adopt from shelters?
This bobcat's heavy. Help, Sassy!
Why bother? We'll just get into more trouble tomorrow?
What's that supposed to mean? Oh, nuts.
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt.
Now back to the Farkas Files with David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio.
And we're back on the Farkas Files with my guest tonight, Hillary Webb, talking about her experiences in Peru with the concept of complementary dualism, but also just your experiences in Peru. Because when last seen, our heroine was going into a ceremony involving a hallucinogenic cactus, right?
That's right. Yep, San Pedro, and also known as Huachuma.
So, which is very common in a number of traditions, and what was that like?
It was beautiful, I have to say, and really, again, really interesting. You know, I'd said before, you know, here I am, I'm somebody who has been kind of working in these realms since I was a little kid in one way or another, really somebody who loves to go have altered states of consciousness in various ways, but it was interesting to see my reaction when Amado, the shaman I primarily worked with, said, no, we're going to, you know, in order for you to understand this concept of Yanantin and Masintin, you need to go into ceremony. And sort of the mental wrangling I had to go through in order to sort of get myself there, where I really felt not only getting past my own fear, but my own doubt. And I think fear and doubt being wrapped up one in the, inside the other, you know, my doubt led me to fear that I could, I didn't feel like I could ever have that kind of experience where I could actually get knowledge in that way, even though, you know, I'd had these experiences before. So I did finally decide to go into ceremony and had a beautiful experience, and I could read a little bit of it if we have time.
Sure.
All right. Okay, so just... four of us, me and three shamans, went up to the mountains this one evening, and let's see, I go into a lot more detail about the ceremony itself, but we did some ceremony and each had a cup of the San Pedro, and this is where I begin. The four of us lay down in our sleeping bags and closed our eyes, waiting for the San Pedro to take effect. Time passed. I must have fallen asleep because I was suddenly jolted awake, feeling as though I had just remembered something important, something essential even, as if a thousand dreams that I had ever had but then forgotten had returned to me all at once. There was a brief moment of awareness, and then it was gone, frustratingly gone. And then, in the next moment, another sensation overcame me, one that can only be described as a simultaneous splitting and adjoining of myself. While on the one hand I was aware of having a very strong sense of emotion, many emotions in fact, perhaps even all emotions, another part of me felt completely detached, almost clinical. It was as though I could both observe my emotions in a completely objective way, while at the same time be fully subjectively saturated with feelings, ecstatic and painful and everything in between. And then I will skip ahead a little more because I know we don't have a ton of time here. I had an interaction with Juan Luis, one of the shamans, who said, you know, it's good to feel in the middle. Being sad and being happy are states of mind. You know, it's best to be in the middle. So after we had had that conversation, I continue. I lay back in my sleeping bag looking up at the colors of the moon. It was exquisite, light pinks and greens and golds all swirling together in a misty haze. How had I never seen that before? The sky itself was nothing less than miraculous, crystal clear like a dim, big dome placed over me. How amazing they were, those streaks of constellations. Had I ever seen so many stars at one time? And then as I watched, the stars began to move, to dance. I closed my eyes, expecting them to be still when I opened them, but even then they continued to hop around the sky like fireflies. I was overjoyed. I felt as though I had been let in on the deepest secret of the cosmos, that the stars move when no one is watching them. And yet at the same time that I watched them dance, seeing this unfold with my eyes wide open, there was a part of my mind that knew this was not real, that it was an illusion created by the San Pedro, that the stars do not really move. As much as I wanted them to move, as much as I wanted them to be conscious and alive and joyful, another part of me reminded myself that this could not be. But then I would look back up at them again, and they would be moving anyway, despite the insistence of that logical voice. And then I would wonder again if maybe they really do move, don't move, do move, don't move, after all. Which was real? Both seem real, and while on the one hand I felt euphoric, at the same time I feared my mind would split in two from the weight of the contradiction. Moving or not moving, real or not real, the tension created in my consciousness by these two opposing thoughts reached a kind of critical mass, one that I thought would be too much to withstand. But then suddenly, the two thoughts in their fight for dominance seemed to wear each other out. It was then that I understood. It was both. The stars both move and don't move all at once. In that moment, I was accepted fully and completely the stars' movement and non-movement as equal realities, without question or doubt or the need to make one or the other. That was it. Yanantine. Captured by this vision, life took on new significance for me. It became clear how much time and energy is wasted trying to determine what was true or untrue, whether we people are wonderful or terrible, splendid or savage, or on a more personal level, whether I myself was lovable or entirely unlovable. These roles that we create for ourselves, the divine and the demonic, at which point do we stop existing as a mixture of both and become one thing or another? It is when we are in the process of observing ourselves, of self-reflecting, of trying to figure out if we are one thing or the other and act accordingly. And then I continue on to some other experiences that I had, but that's just a little clip of my first experience with the San Pedro ceremony.
Totally amazing, yeah.
And it was beautiful. And again, there really is something, I mean, I have nothing obviously against book learning. I think facts and figures are fabulous, but there really is nothing that can compare to having a embodied personal experience of a different paradigm. And that's what I find is the joy of this whole process.
And, you know, people, one of the things that goes on in our culture is defining anything that's non-ordinary as being crazy. Mm-hmm. And I'm always comforted by the fact that Albert Einstein had those experiences. That's the core of his scientific research was having what he called thought experiments. Mm. where he'd go into a reverie state. And when he was 16, he had the first that first experience of asking what it would be like to sit, to travel at the speed of light. And he sat on a light, on a beam of light, to see what it would be like.
Cool.
And had an experience of it. And then came back and did the math years later and said, you know, oh, well, if that's true, then this must be true. And then the math will do this. Oh, look, the math does do that. And one of the books I read said that in his early notes about the behavior of waves of light, he wrote, it looks in the math like the waves are lumpy. It was before he had come up with the concept of particles, but he was already seeing that it couldn't be what he thought it was, or at least it wasn't that all the time.
That's cool. Yeah.
You know, and it's the same thing. Okay, I've got this concept over here, but what I saw and what's happening in the math as I analyze it says that there's more going on. What's that more that's going on? And out of that came the idea of things being both waves and particles, and eventually quantum physics, which usually to most people sounds at least as crazy as anything mystical or shamanic, if not more so.
It's true. Yeah, I love that. I mean, it's true. You see, you hear stories like that, and there are so many of them. I believe Descartes, you know, had his inspiration through a dream of an angel who said the conquest of nature is to be found through number and measure. You know, and despite that, our culture has a really, really hard time, the dominant part of our culture has a hard time accepting the epistemological, throw out a $10 graduate school word, value, the way of knowing, you know, of non-ordinary states of consciousness as a means by which we can know the world. And, it's remarkable how little attention is paid to these ways of knowing, and very sad in my mind.
Well, at least in the United States and the Western countries,
yeah,
in the former Soviet Union and now Russia, and certainly in China, they are doing consciousness studies and the effect of consciousness on physical matter and waves and all the rest of it. I heard Dean Radin speak. He's the chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and he's doing this stuff in California. And he said there are about 100 scientists doing hard science about the relationship of consciousness to the physical world, but only 6 of them are in the United States.
I believe it. Yeah, Dean's doing very interesting work with the random event generators.
I sat talking with him about it, and I said, you know, have you tried it from further than 7 feet away?
Mm-hmm. And what did he say?
He was curious about it, but there were going to be technical things that had to be worked out, and I never heard back from him that he had worked that out.
Yeah.
For me to work remotely and still have it be the experiment he was doing was going to require some software changes and various computer things, and never did happen. But I mentioned it to a couple of other friends that are shamans, and we all got gleeful. It's like, oh, yeah, affect the double slit experiment? I can think of about 6 ways I would affect that.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, isn't it more and more what we're learning about consciousness is it really works at a non-local level? I mean, not only would you not have to be in the same room to affect something, but you could feasibly do it 2 days later and affect something that happened in the past.
Yeah, that's the part that makes people even crazier.
You can
look at the past and the future.
That's why this work is really for people who like the questions and not the answers.
Exactly right. Yeah. You know, people frequently say, you know, what you do is strange. And I go, you think I didn't notice? I mean, I'm
right.
You know, I'm here.
Yeah.
I know it's strange. And what keeps the grounding and the sanity to it is I know people all over the world that do similar work, each in their own particular flavor and seasoning, depending on, you know, who they are, where they are, and what they learned. But we can confirm things for each other.
Mm.
So I can send an email or call somebody up or get on Skype and say, take a look at this. take a look at it at this time and date, take a look at it now. Mm-hmm. Tell me what you see here and what you see after. And they'll give me the same counts of things that I found.
Cool.
Or the even better one, because there's absolutely no chance that the reporter is lying, is when there are psychic children, especially small children in a house. And they will report to their parents, who are usually not psychic, oh, there were three of these and two of these, and these looked really mean. And, you know, and then when I send them the report and I give them the numbers in the report, they match what the kids say.
Yeah. Wow. That'll blow your mind.
Right. Right. Yeah. So, you know, consistent anecdotal data, but no way to create an experiment because you can't limit the variables.
Right.
To do the kind of thing that experimental science requires. But there's 9,000 years of history in every indigenous culture talking about this stuff and talking about the same ways of culturally different, but the same basic concepts and the same ways of understanding things and working with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think part of the challenge in the study of consciousness is not only figuring out what consciousness, quote unquote, is, but the methodology by which we might, I mean, really, I think we haven't even figured out what methods by which to study consciousness most
right.
effectively. And I do think that it's probably in, you know, I think that there, the scientific method is useful in certain aspects of the study of consciousness, but I don't think that it really covers the whole gamut of the research that can be done and should be done.
Right.
So I'm often surprised the closed-mindedness with which I find when I interact with consciousness researchers about, you know, different methodologies of doing this kind of thing. But then also plenty of people who really are very forward-thinking and open-minded about it, and that really is very exciting about technology these days. We can really get in touch with, you know, the Russians or whoever's doing the work. So I think
right.
I think we're really at a good time of really sinking our teeth into this.
Yep. I sat over dinner with a physicist from Australia. And, you know, he's kind of tolerating me with a smirk. And he finally said, you know, your explanation is as good as anything we've got about what we see under the electron microscope.
See, there
because
you go.
There are molecules that are doing things that clearly they want to do because they're not doing what we're trying to make them do.
Mm.
They will just go back to doing what they were doing before because it's what they do.
Yeah.
And saying that they're conscious makes as much sense. It's outside of our paradigm, but it makes as much sense to what we're observing as anything that we're trying to come up with.
Yeah.
Which was a lot of fun. There are people that are open to it. But part of my frustration, not that I have access to people to do this very much, is they're looking for entry points and perspectives that will allow them to do the experimental science. And the shamanic practitioners are the ones who see things or experience things that are not yet available to any technology.
Mm-hmm.
So right. I know a lot of people that see the energy of the universe as grids. In various ways, we all have slightly different versions of what the readout looks like in our minds. But they coordinate. They're very similar. We talk about them the same way that we talk about changes in them in very similar ways. And that idea that there are discrete points connected by lines of energy, which in Hindu scripture was called the net of jewels. You know, that only goes back like 4,000 years. You know, but you don't get to have that conversation with someone who's looking for a new way to look at it because there isn't that interface that in that way to talk. Dean talks about how when he talks to a real straight group of scientists, they'll roll their eyes and sit there with their arms crossed until he's done. And then there's this long line of people that will come up privately and tell him, yeah, we know all of that, but we'd lose our grants and be, you know, drummed out of the core if we ever said we believed it.
Right.
So the understanding may be there, but there isn't support in the scientific community and certainly in the funding community, except probably for certain covert government programs.
And who knows what they're up to.
Right. You know, because it's a fascinating field of study for that kind of thing.
Oh, absolutely. So,
you know, one of the things I found fascinating, and I'm going to finish the book for sure and then call you up, mm-hmm. Is you really were led into these experiences with gentle teachers who told you what to expect and gave you the reasons and all of that. My experience was much more being tricked into being someplace and left there.
That's one way to do it.
You know, oh, you should see this. Oh, no, I'm not going to be here.
Sink or swim, baby.
Right. Being thrown into the deep end of the pool with someone just going, oh, he's not drowning. That's good.
Yeah.
Which I think is, in many cases, more what apprenticeship is like. You do a lot of stuff that seems like it's a lot of nothing. And when the teacher finally goes, yeah, oh, they're ready to have this done to them, and you get thrown into it. Or the circumstances come up. My other teacher, I stopped by his house for no apparent reason. He said, what are you doing here? And like, I don't know. Spirit told me to stop. And he got a phone call, and he got off the phone. There's all the shrinking on the phone, and he's pulling stuff out of drawers. And he said, well, you want to come do an exorcism? I'm like, yeah, I knew I stopped by for something.
Like I said, so sink or swim, baby.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
one of those turning point events in my experience, and it was random.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think so many of these initiations involve a deconstruction, both physical and psychological and spiritual.
Right.
So they tend to be pretty hair-raising and scary, and I mean, I think that's part of the process whatever way works, get you out of your habits.
Right. And one of my perspectives is that you get desensitized to weirdness in the same way that medical or emergency personnel get desensitized to blood and pain and, you know, are able to be in the presence of all of that. To be doing this work, you have to be exposed to things that other people would never experience and would run from, very weird stuff, and eventually get to the point where it's just, oh, yeah. Well, it's not exactly what I experienced before, but no weirder than that was.
Right.
And allows you to stay present in the moment, to have the experience, ask, what am I, how can I understand this experience? What do I need to do? What would you have me do? What next?
Yeah.
So that you can stay there and do that and not... As people who have experimented with, for example, hallucinogenic drugs, as recreational drugs, don't always come back in good shape.
Right, that's true.
Because they haven't had the structure and the training to lead them into it, and they didn't have people there with them to hold them in such a way that they could go through the experience and not come apart.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think that's the value of having really good teachers, because a really good teacher will be observant and will know, okay, time to take this step, time to take this step. Now it's time to take this leap. You know, one of the questions that people will often ask me is my work with psychedelics is, you know, do you think people should be running around, you know, doing psychedelics? Is that something that should be part of our culture here? And, you know, part of my answer is, well, I do wish that our culture had less fear of the mind and more opportunities for this to be done in a contained environment. I mean, the difference between, you know, college students having an LSD experience in a dorm room versus having an experience with a shaman, not to say that something of benefit can't come from an LSD experience in a dorm room, but really being with the shamans, they do make this container where there is intent and structure.
And safety.
And safety, exactly. And it keeps you in a mode where it's not just some crazy experience that you're having, but it teaches you something. And the things that you learn aren't lost. They become psycho-integrated, so they stay with you the rest of your life. I mean, that was certainly my experience.
Yeah. Yeah. And it makes it possible for you to go into something else, whether it's drug-induced or... in some other way. One of the things about the way that I was taught to work and the way that I work is there is no drama at all. I don't use any of that. And, you know, it's just a shift in consciousness. And for a lot of people, it's like, well, how do you get into trance? How do you get there? It's like, I just do it. Mm-hmm. You know, there wasn't any of that. So that, again, is in effect a cultural difference, but certainly a technique difference. And, you know, there are as many ways to get into an altered state and non-ordinary reality as there are cultures in the world and practitioners.
Mm, absolutely. Yep.
But the experiences and the kinds of things that you see are very obviously, even though they're described differently in different cultures, they're very obviously all the same thing. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you so much for being with me. We have to. You're another one of the people that I've met where it's like, how many of these conversations can we have?
As many as you want. I enjoy talking about this very much. So it's really been a pleasure.
It's been a total pleasure having you on here. Thanks for sharing this. Give us the website again and the name of your book so that people can find you.
Well, my website is www.hillarysweb.com. And my latest book is Yanantin and Masintin in the Andean Worlds, and I'm also the author of Traveling Between the Worlds, Conversations with Contemporary Shamans, and Exploring Shamanism. And, you know, I'm really eager to hear from people about how, you know, all this stuff lands for them and their personal perspective. And so I encourage people to contact me with their own stories and thoughts, and, you know, I love to have dialogues about this. So people are welcome to contact me through my website.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Thank you so much, Hillary.
Thank you.
If people are interested in finding my work, you'll find it at househealing.com, and you can contact me through the contact tab, which even cleverly has a link to make an appointment with me, because I'll do a 20-minute reading and assessment and see what's going on with you and whether my work is appropriate. Very excited about next week's guest. Next week, my guest is Stephen Simon. And how many of you know who he is? I'm not sure. But he was the producer and or director of Somewhere in Time, What Dreams May Come, Indigo the Movie, among other things that he was involved in. And he was also one of the people that started the Spiritual Cinema Circle, which distributes consciousness-oriented movies that normally would not have much of an audience, and they distribute them on DVD every year. They do, or at least they used to do, film conventions and things like that. I worked with Stephen at Spiritual Cinema for a while. I am so glad to get a chance to reconnect with him and get his take on a whole bunch of things, both spirituality in the movies, but also what's going on in the world. He's a really interesting guy. I want to go back to the metaphysical musing just for a minute and just say to people, watch life a little differently. Look how many times you say, oh, that's just a coincidence, and want to continue walking away. And instead of walking away, ask some questions about it. See what's going on there. That's the juiciness of this work. It is having that shift in consciousness in the moment where instead of letting it go, you go, oh, I wonder what this means. And I wonder how I can work with it. And I wonder what it will teach me. It's really a fascinating way to be in the world. So until next week, again, same bad time, same bad station. This is David Franklin Farkas from HouseHealing.com on the Farkas Files. And truth is in here somewhere. We'll be back on next Thursday. Please be with us.